So tonight is, as you know, tonight is Hanukkah. Those are the good words to our song, and we're gonna try to focus today on the night of Hanukkah. And here I'll tell you what one of the biggest challenges that I have, and I'm sure we've all had this challenge with Hanukkah, and that is that Hanukkah is so long with so little text. Meaning, like, you get to Purim, there's a whole Megillah, literally, right? And then when you get to Hanukkah, it's like there's nothing. There's like you have 8 days of it, and there's not even any there's no Megillah, there's no text, there's very little even rabbinic text. If you look in all of Tanakh, there's no text on Hanukkah whatsoever. You look in all of the rabbinic text, there's essentially, I would say, the maximum of 2.5 double pages dedicated to Hanukkah in total, over all of the 2,000 plus. Pages in the whole of the Talmud. So you're like, you know, what are we supposed to do for all these 8 days? How are we supposed to know about it? We're all very into understanding and getting and appreciating what we're doing, but where does it come from? So here's the kicker of the whole thing, and that is we want to really get a sense of appreciation of the fact that it may be that Hanukkah happened well after it all started, well after Tanakh finished. But ultimately, actually, it really appears earlier. Meaning to say that the framework of Hanukkah started way before Hanukkah actually ever occurred. And that's going to be our test tonight. One second, just want to check one thing. So, what we're going to do is we're going to try to reverse ourselves backwards in history and say, well, when did Hanukkah occur when it wasn't really yet Hanukkah? That's our goal for tonight. Can we find places that it did exist? It's something that sounded like it existed, but it wasn't yet it. It was kind of the archetype of it. Because as you know, in the Jewish year, it isn't that just like, you know, an event happened to happen in a certain time. There are certain times, there's auras around certain time periods, and within those auras, certain events that reflect that. So, for instance, like, you know, the fact that we have Pesach in the spring, at least in the northern hemisphere, is indicative or is indicated in the fact that there's a renewal, there's a blossoming in general in the world. It's the Aviv. So that resonant season is the season of renewal, which allowed it to be that redemption would take place during that aura of season. So the question is what else occurs around now, which was we'll call it, you know, the same aura which allowed Hanukkah to happen around this time. That's our question. So what we're going to do is we're going to go all the way back to the very, 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 very beginning. In order to do that, we're going to take a text of the Gemara itself and then move our way backwards with that. So we're going to take a look at start on text 2. This is the Gemara itself, one of the very, very few places that the Torah itself talks about what it is that Hanukkah is. And the Gemara tells us in source 2, this is the Gemara in Shabbos Chof Aleph from Abayis. And what I want to just focus on is the strangeness of this text. This is a very unusual text. The text says the following: "My Hanukkah. What is Hanukkah?" That's a pretty good question, right? Because we're all there. We all want to appreciate it. The Gemara explains: "The Tanur Rabbanon, the Chofei BeKislev, on the 25th of Kislev. That was today in the day. Yomei de Hanukkah, the Etam Naya Inon. They were 8 days of Hanukkah. Deloy leMispar Bohon, uDeloy leSanos Bohon." There are days you cannot eulogize and you cannot fast on, meaning there are happy days you can't do negative-sounding things or depressing things on them. Now, if I were to ask you what is Hanukkah all about, that's a little bit of a strange description of it after all, right? Meaning, tell me what it is, not what it isn't, right? Hanukkah is the day that we light candles. Hanukkah is the time that we have donuts. Hanukkah is the time we dance with our families. Hanukkah is the time we have loud music. Hanukkah is the time we go to the park. And there's all kinds of things we can talk about. The Gemara says it's the days we don't. We don't fast. We don't make hespedim. We don't do eulogize. That's the kind of very negative description. It's sort of like drawing the silhouette of what Hanukkah is, rather than telling us what it is. So now the Gemara continues with the story. Why? Shekeshe nichnasu yavanim. This is in the source 2, the end of the first line. When the Greeks entered the Laheichal, the temple, timu kol hashmonin. We know the story. They impurified all of the oils. And then when the Chashmonaim re-entered, they looked all over, they checked to see even one, and they were only able to find one jug of oil, that had the seal of the high priest. There was only enough to light on one day, and it lasted for 8 days. Fantastic. That's all the story of Hanukkah we know and love. Fantastic. And the Gemara then concludes, Lashana Acheres, which literally means another year, meaning just in the year following, ostensibly, or a time period following. They made them days of thanksgiving and praise. Great. That's the origins of Chanukah. So when you look at this Gemara over here, the Gemara is trying to give us the format for this. It happens to be, there is one other place in all of the Talmud that it uses that same last description, in that highlighted text, that another year they fixed this as an eight-day festival. That text appears in only one other place in the Talmud, and it happens to be, I just had the opportunity last year of working a little bit with Rav Foreman on this particular idea. It's an idea which I heard many, many years ago in the name of Rav Moshe Shapiro, that originally appears. Very, very fascinating idea, and it goes as follows. This is the first Chanukah of Tanakh. It starts at the very, very beginning, way before we ever imagined it. Here's the Gemara. The Gemara says the following in Avodah Zarah. The Gemara in Avodah Zarah is talking about different cycles of polytheistic religions. Why? Because we need to be aware of when those religions celebrate their festivals, because we're not allowed to do business in the times where people would really serve Avodah Zarah. We weren't allowed to do business with those people around their festivals, because we're not allowed to invest in them. We're not allowed to give them pleasure before or on their festivals, because they'll go and thank their gods. Right? It's not as much of an issue today. There are very few polytheists who are very into their festivals as they were in those days. Okay, but the Gemara is going through a number of different descriptions, and it's talking about two festivals now. These two festivals are called Saturnalia and Kalenda. Kalenda we know a little less about. Saturnalia you can look up on Wikipedia. It's very fascinating festival. Lots of interesting history in the Roman Empire particularly, and how that had its origins in what we have as Christmas today, just interestingly enough. But nonetheless, this is what the Gemara is talking about. So remember, we're talking in a text, you know, at minimum 1,500 years ago. So these are the festivals. Here's what the Gemara says, and it relates a fascinating story in this first source. Amar Rav Chanan bar Rava, kalenda, that's the word kalenda day, ches yamim achar tzukufa, saturnura, saturnalia, ches yamim lifnei tzukufa. There were these two festivals. They're both eight-day-long festivals, and they preceded and followed the solstice. Tekufa means the solstice. When is the solstice, the winter solstice? Today, we have it as December 21st, right? So around December 21st, which is today, the solstice, before and afterwards, that would be a solstice festival. And by the way, many, many, many polytheistic religions have solstice festivals, right? These are all the festivals that surround the shortest day of the year. And he quotes a way of remembering this. Skipping to the period. Tana Rabbana, our rabbis taught, that was the abbreviation. When Adam first saw the days were decreasing, Omar Oili Shema Bishil Shesarachti Olum Chashuch Ba'adi. He says, maybe the world is darkening because of me. And let's think about this. When do we appreciate, when was Adam and Chava, when were they created? At which point in the year? We generally understand that they were created at what date? Rosh Hashanah. Rosh Hashanah, right? So we understand the world started on the 25th of Kislev. The sixth day of creation was the creation of humanity, which means that the creation of humanity is in Elul, the end of Elul, beginning of Tishrei, which is why our judgment's on that same day, meaning to say we have to get up there and get in the dock and explain why we need to carry on existing every time it's our birthday, ultimately, while it's humanity's birthday. Right? That's why it's at that cycle. So now, what happens on the first day of creation? Adam Arishon is created, and first day they get out there, there's one thing they're not supposed to do, and they do it. They eat from that tree. It's all on the same day. The Gemara tells us in Sanhedrin that they sin on the first day of creation, which means Adam sins, Hashem says, you're going to die, right? There's going to be death. He doesn't know what death is. He's only lived one day at this point in time. What starts happening? He clearly is in the northern hemisphere in that cycle of seasons. And what's happening? And every day he notices that Mincha is earlier, right? Because the days are getting shorter. So Adam has this terrible sinking feeling that what is death? Death is as life slowly drains away, right? The plant, the foliage is starting to wilt. The weather is getting colder. There's less sunlight. Life is diminishing. So that is an expression of what I did. This is what we did. We created this death, and it's carrying on going. So what did he do? How did he respond to this? at the end of the fourth line, this is the death that I was punished with. As it was getting really bad, he started davening and fasting for 8 days to try to change the cycle. Maybe he can break away from what was happening. When he reached the nadir, the very bottom point, and it started getting short, and the day started getting just a little bit incrementally longer once again, then he realized, Omar min hagoy shel olam hu. It's just the way the world works. Meaning, it's a cycle. It's a cycle. This is the first time it happened. He hadn't seen this before. It's going to come back. There's going to be summer. There's going to be spring. I'm going to live again. Right? That's what the Adam HaRishon experienced. Can you imagine like this? The paradigm shift that's going through his mind. Holach v'asa shmoni yomim tovim. So he made 8-day festival. Fantastic. Lashana acheres. Here's our description. Another year later, asan la'elu v'la'elu yomim tovim. Humanity took both these sets of 8 days, the days of fear and fasting, and the days of rejoicing and thanksgiving, and turned both of those 8 sets into festivals. Which is interesting, by the way, just psychologically, turning what was fear into rejoicing. It's just interesting, meaning to say, you can imagine that those two festivals that humanity experienced them very differently, right? One was about relief, and one was about fear, which turned into relief. And Adam was very firm about doing this for the sake of God. And they turned them into polytheistic festivals. Which is interesting. Humanity generally does this, as we sort of take something which was good at the beginning and convert it or transform it into something somewhat negative. And the Gemara is therefore asserting that where do you see these solstice festivals emerging from? Or from the calendar in Saturnalia, or Saturnuna, as the Gemara calls it, is originally from Adam HaRishon's experience. What's fascinating is, if you want to just do the math quickly, this is a very interesting thing. If the world was created on the 25th of Kislev, and the solar year is 365 days, a quarter of the year, of course, is always 91 days. Right, so there's always going to be a 91-day four shifts. Solstices and equinoxes are divided are essentially taking the year and slicing it into four pieces. Right, so when we talk about the equinoxes, which are sort of in between seasons, and the solstices, the shortest and the longest days, they are essentially quarter markers of the year. Right, in the solar year. So the first year, if it was created with the assumption being that, now it's just hard to make this assumption, but let's assume that the world is created on an equinox. Now it's hard to say because again the celestial bodies are only created on day four, but it's just as if we were to say that that's a starting point of equinox, and the movement is downwards towards solstice, right? So it's going, the days are shortening, shortening, shortening until the solstice, then back up again. 91 days later is the 25th of Kislev, as an interesting point, which is fascinating, which means that when was the turning point of Adam's realization of this turn in the light shift is the 25th of Kislev, which of course wasn't yet, but was to be Chanukah. So it's interesting that, and of course this is the festival of light and dark, right? Meaning to say, Chanukah is essentially the 8 days marking the end of that period of declining darkness, right? So meaning to say, we haven't seen Chanukah yet, but what the Gemara is essentially saying is that the format of Chanukah, the pattern of Chanukah, existed way before the Greeks ever existed, way before the Chashmonaim ever existed, way before any temples were fought over. It was simply the way the world experienced it. And that's why, if you look at all of these pagan religions, you'll see all of them have solstice festivals. Why? Because they all are transmuting, or in a certain sense, taking away from Adam's original experience, which is what the Gemara is describing. Fascinating. Apparently, Chanukah is not a takeoff of this, but Chanukah ultimately is the original coding of that pattern before it went awry. That's what the Gemara is telling us. Fascinating. So we'll call this. If we're going to try to put this on the board, this is hidden Chanukah number one, right? The first Chanukah that we have. We're going to try to focus on another four hidden Chanukahs which arrive before we get to the Chanukah that we know and love as it happens. So somehow in the very cycle of the year, the solar cycle of the year, Chanukah is inbuilt. It is fascinating for those who are counting that, of course, you know, December 25th is, of course, a very important festival for many Christians. And that, if you count the days from December 25th to January 1st, it is 25, 26, 27, 28, 29, 30, 31, 1. That's 8 days as well. It is interesting to know that, and it isn't by coincidence, because if you read the history of Saturnalia, you'll see that part of what the Christian Empire did was to incorporate pagan festivals to be able to help bring in the crowds in order into the religion. So it's very fascinating, because remember, before the times of Constantine and a little bit afterwards as well, Christianity was very much persecuted by the pagan culture surrounding them, until the Roman Empire actually became Christian. But part of it was there was a fight of culture. And this the original Christmas was in fact a permutation of the Saturnalia, and had a number of the accompanying practices which were pretty morbid as well, which accompanied it as well. So just fascinating take off again of what the Squire was saying. Let's shift a little further into history. We're going to shift now 2,500 years essentially into history, way before Hanukkah, but way after creation. So the second time we encounter a hidden Hanukkah is the following. There is a remarkable, I don't know if we're going to do all the texts inside just because of the sake of timing, but the text is here for your edification if it is of interest. The Yalkut Shimoni, which is one of the Midrashim, the Midrash Agada, this is in Sefer Melachim, says a fascinating idea. And that is, actually Rashi quotes this on the Torah, this is a well-known idea. When the Mishkan was made, Moshe Rabbeinu came down from Har Sinai, he came down on the day of Yom Kippur. That was the day we achieved atonement. He then says, folks, you know, you use that gold and stuff to make that egel? Well, I got a new idea about gold. So here's the deal. You take off the gold, we put it in, and we're going to make a Mishkan. Right? That's how it's going to work. And everybody was very enthusiastic. Fastest building campaign in history. It took 3 days, and they had more than they needed. And we got to ask Moshe about how he did this exactly. We haven't yet got the secrets. But nonetheless, this was a pretty remarkable moment in history. He collects everything on the 15th of Tishrei when they started making the Mishkan. When was the Mishkan complete? We know when it was inaugurated. It was inaugurated on the 1st of Nisan, but when was it complete? So interestingly enough, the Yalkut Shimoni, this Midrash says, the day it was complete was on the 25th of Kislev. So it took them roughly just over 2 months for them to build the Mishkan till the completion of the Mishkan. And everybody wanted to do it then, but Moshe Rabbeinu says, wait. He understood that Hashem wanted to build it in the month that Yitzhak Avinu was born, which is Nisan. Which is fascinating. Why does Yitzchak have to do with the Mishkan? Just a very fascinating question to explore. I'm not sure I have such clarity on this yet. But apparently Hashem wanted to wait till Nisan to make the Mishkan. This is all in the Yalkut Shimoni. And everybody started whispering and saying, Moshe Rabbeinu, maybe there's a problem. Not everything came together. Maybe not all the monies, right? You know, all the things. The op-eds started coming into the local papers. And everybody had their theories as to why this was all waiting. And Hashem says, don't worry, Kislev. I know that you've been gypped now, but there's going to be a time in the future that I'm going to use you as an inauguration time. When's that going to be? In the future, the time of the Chashmonaim, who are not going to dedicate, but they're going to rededicate my home. Right? Meaning the base of Midrash was already built. They weren't building it, but they were essentially purifying and rededicating had become nitma, what had become impure. So isn't it interesting? In a certain sense, the Chanukah, the second hidden Chanukah in history, is the Chanukah which was waiting for the dormant month of Kislev, which should have been, could have been, and almost was the first building of the Mishkan and became the second purification of the second temple. That's the second one. Fascinating, right? This is just, again, it was kind of waiting. It was almost like the debt in time that Kislev had against all the rest of the months, and it found its fruition in Chanukah. Okay, so Adam Arishon, moving on to the dormant month of Kislev, which had the Mishkan, but it gets more than that. So now if we fast forward a few months from the origins of the Mishkan till when it was actually dedicated in Nisan, what happened was that it wasn't just like they cut the ribbon and everything was fine. They broke the bottle of champagne and everybody went home. It was interesting that there was a whole 12-day process of this inauguration. And every one of these days, there was a gift brought by these people called the Nesiim. Right? These are the princes of each tribe would bring a very special and elaborate gift. You know, they brought a cart and cows and incense and goats, the whole business, right? This was all a dedication, and this was a pretty expensive gift. Each of them brought their own one every single day. And for those who are in shul, every single day of Chanukah, we lay in one of their gifts. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8. On the 8th day, we read the 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, because there's 12 of them. Right? But we read that section on Chanukah as the Kriyas HaTorah. And that's actually called, in the Torah, it's called Chanukas HaNasiim, the dedication of the Nasiim. It was in Nisan, but Chanukah means dedication. So they were dedicating to the temple. Fantastic. Now, what does that have to do with us? Because that is the end of Parshas Naso. Naso is the longest parsha in the Torah because it has essentially 12 carbon copy paragraphs of each of the gifts of the Nisim, which take up a lot of space in the parsha. The immediately following section of the Torah, after the Chanukas HaNasiim, is what begins the next parasha. Following Naso is the parashas. Baloscha, fantastic, good. just making sure that at this time of night that the gears are still turning. So Baloscha is the immediately following parasha after Naso. Now let's go through the first pasuk of Baloscha. When you light the candles, El Mul Paneha Menorah Ya'ires Sheva Saneros. Isn't it interesting? Immediately following the dedication of the Nisim, which is called Chanukas Hamizbeach, is a section which talks about the lighting of the menorah. Now, the lighting of the menorah was not talking about the lighting of Aaron menorahs. Let's be clear about that. It's talking about Aaron HaKohen in the Mishkan lighting the seven-branched candelabra, right? This is just to be clear about this. But it is interesting. It's kind of like, it has got an interesting innuendo to it that's relevant to us. So, the Rashi comments that says the following. Well, there actually is a story behind all this. Because here's how it goes. If you count through all those 12 days, you'll notice something interesting. And that is that all the tribes are represented, all the tribes, that is, except for Levi. Levi didn't get a cut. It was Menashe and Ephraim got split into two, but Levi dropped out. There are really 13 tribes, essentially, right? Because once Ephraim and Menashe split into two of Yosef, Levi kind of receded and didn't have his spot. So the Rashi records, based on the Midrash, that Aaron felt very terribly upset. Here it is, everybody gets their, you know, pomp and circumstance. They bring in their carts, and there's Aaron sitting there watching the whole proceedings, and he doesn't have any representation, no plaque on the wall, no ribbon to cut, nothing. So what happens? Aaron felt bad, and Hashem says, "Don't worry, Aaron, I'm going to allow you to light the menorah and clean the menorah every morning. You light it at night, you're going to clean it in the morning, you get a special job. Don't worry. Shelcha gedola mishalohem. Yours is more important than even theirs. Don't worry, Aaron." And that's why, says Rashi, there's a proximity between their dedications and Aaron's lighting the menorah. Fantastic. The only thing which is not so fantastic is like, I don't know, if I was Aaron, I don't know if I'd be so consoled. Meaning it's like, you know what it is? It's like, you know, you have a whole building fund, you put up a new building, everybody's so excited, that it's the big day, it's, you know, you have the whole video crew, and everybody's at the front, and everybody who's anybody who's in that picture, in the front page of every Jewish paper, and they cut the ribbon, and they pull over the curtain, and there's one person who just wasn't there, and they say, "Oh, we're so sorry, I forgot you, don't worry, you get to pay the janitor." It's like, really? Like, upkeep's really important. You should know. You don't worry about the plaque. Don't worry about anything else. Don't worry about the picture. You have upkeep. It's like, that's just like, I don't know. I feel like I missed the boat a little bit. You know what I'm saying? So like, Aaron, you get to light the menorah. That's it. Great. Fantastic. Every morning you're going to come in. Nobody's going to, you're going to keep the plate. You're going to keep the lights in this place on. I don't know. So the Ramban asks that question. The Ramban asks, and the Ramban's here, we're not going to go do it inside, but the Ramban asks that exact question. That just doesn't make sense. Why it should be that he got this. And moreover, if you want to console Aaron and say, "Aaron, you got great stuff going on," you know you should say, "Aaron, you got the Korbanos." Meaning like, you know, this is the moment. The Korbanos, everybody comes together, everybody sings, there's a whole accompanying choir. That's a little more, you know, the menorah is like inside. It's like, you know, it's like nobody really even sees that. Right, we all have pictures of it, but that wasn't a public ceremony. So the Ramban says no. He quotes a remarkable midrash, the midrash which he actually doesn't. We don't have inside, but he quotes it in the name of. Let me see if I can find where it is. Megidas Sasari, the hidden midrash of Rabbeinu Nissen that he quotes from the Gaonic period, and he says the following. Yeah, let's actually take a look at this on the very, very top of page 3, just to see his expression itself. I found in the hidden Megillah of Rabbeinu Nissim, Shehizkir Agada Azu V'Omar. Ro'esi B'Medrash, I saw in the Medrash, Kevon Shekrivu Shneim Asar Shvatim V'lo Hikriv Shevet Levi, because all the other tribes brought their dedication and Levi did not, V'chuloi, etc. So Hashem responded to Aaron's upset by saying, Amon HaKadosh Baruch Hu, Hashem said to Aaron, L'Moshe, Daber El Aaron V'Amar Te'elov, tell Aaron you're going to light the menorah. Yesh Chanukah Acheres Shiyesh Bo Hadlokos Neros V'Ani Oisei Bo Li Yisrael Al Yedei Bo Neich. Banecha. Nisim v'tshua. V'chanukah shekruya al-shmam. I'm going to give you a dedication in your this in the, by the hands of your children, and they're going to even call that Chanukah, a dedication. V'hi Chanukas beis Chashmonai, which is going to be in the future when the Chashmonai rededicate the temple. U'lefichach hismich parashazu l'parashas Chanukas ha-mizbeach, and that's why it is put next to the Chanukas ha-mizbeach. I can lashona, quoting, end quotation, which means, Aaron, I'm not telling you you're getting the upkeep of the Mishkan. That's not your consolation. I'm telling you, you're going to also get a dedication. You're also going to have a moment where you dedicate the temple. When's that? Not now. Not next generation. Not even the next generation. It's going to take a long time, but it's going to be in the future, future, future. It's going to be your children's children's children. Because which tribe do the Chashmonaim come from? They are Kohanim. That means to say they are scions of Aaron himself. Your children are going to be the dedicators of the Mishkan or the Mizbeh, the Mikdash itself. Wait. How? Represented in the menorah. But now let's drive backwards a moment. Rashi had said, "Gedolah shelcha mishalahem." Your dedication is even better than these Nasim's dedication. Why? Why is the dedication of the Chashmonaim better than what the Nasim are doing as they dedicate the foremost, first Mishkan? Why is it better than theirs? The longevity. Let's think about this. Some total of years the Mishkan existed was 40 years in the desert, plus minus 369 in Israel. Some total, just over 400 years was the amount of time that the Mishkan existed, and there was a lot of things that happened in between. That's how long their dedication lasted, and even the structure was different, because when they came into Israel, they took away the wooden poles and they made it stone. Okay, so that's how long we can give them. How long did the Chashmonaim's dedication last? Well, it's interesting that it pervades time and place, because even when the Mikdash was destroyed, we carry on lighting. Meaning what we just did tonight, what we lit in our homes, is a representation of their dedication of the Mikdash. Which means to say, their dedication was the ultimate dedication, which was not locked into a specific place and not locked into a specific time. He actually goes on to say a fascinating thing. The Ramban says this is worth chewing on. That the other thing that Aaron got as a consolation was Birkas Kohanim. Because even though Birkas Kohanim happens in the Mikdash, it still carries on today. And that's another thing which his example wasn't limited to time and place, also went beyond. Where does he see that in the Torah? Just out of interest, where does the Ramban see in the Torah that that's also one of the gifts that Aaron got, which was beyond the Chanukah and Nesiim? This is just a very fascinating point to notice. Is that the dedication of the Nesiim in Parshas Nosai is bookended by two things. It starts with Birkas Kohanim and ends with the lighting of the menorah. So the Ramban is saying, just interesting, he isn't saying, it doesn't say this explicitly inside, but he's saying is that, Aaron, you got two things which are going to be well beyond any time or space. Now, that's just a very, very fascinating way of looking at things. But again, this is essentially our third, aura of why it is that Chanukah existed and predated the actual events of Chanukah itself. One, Adam HaRishon. Number two is when the Mishkan was finished but not erected. And number three is even when it was dedicated, but Aaron was told, you need to wait because your dedication is coming. Just an interesting emotional point over here is if you are Aaron, Hashem says, don't worry, Aaron, you're going to have a chance to dedicate. Did Aaron ever see that? Nada. Did his children see it? Nisht. Did his grandchildren see it? So if you think about this for a moment, Aaron, how long did Aaron wait? Aaron died not getting a consolation. His children died not getting a consolation. His grandchildren died not seeing a consolation. It took millennia to get to that point in time where the Chashmonaim eventually upheld the lost dignity of Aaron. So sometimes it's important to just realize that this bigger picture of Aaron is, it takes time. The bigger picture does even itself out, but it takes a little bit of time sometimes. It's just something just worthwhile thinking about in the dimensions that the Ramban is talking about. Okay? Fascinating idea. These are perhaps the most well-known of the Chanukahs, but there's a third one, there's a fourth one, try to keep counts. And this one we'll try to get to. This is a really fascinating historical one. Again, we're still in the times of Tanakh. What we're going to do now is we're going to fast forward. In the old days, remember when you had VHSs, there was a fast forward sound? They don't have that anymore. It's like you lose so much. It's just like the experience of it. Anyway, so we fast forward a little bit, right, to the times where we get now to The first temple has been and gone, and now they're in the Golus of Babel. The Golus of Babel takes about 70 years plus minus, and now this is the way we find ourselves. Okay, so we look around, we get our time capsule. Everybody's wearing Babylonian garb at this point in time. Persian styles are coming in. We're now living at the end of that period. It's a period which is called in Jewish history courts called Shivas Zion, the return to Zion. Why? Because the Jews are now living in Persian-controlled Babylonia area. And the Persians have got a general, their general foreign policy is a lot more benign than the Babylonians. Babylonians were pretty rough people. Everybody they came across, they pretty much killed. That was their foreign policy. It was pretty successful for however long it lasted. But it didn't last so long. They got killed very, very, very shortly after they rose to power. Babylonians were fast rising and fast dying. The Persians had much longer longevity, and their foreign policy was a lot more benign. They said, what we're going to do is we have a lot of vassal states, and we're going to allow the indigenous people in each vassal state to return to their places and govern themselves and pay Persian taxes. That was their general foreign policy. And that means those people from Judea, who call themselves Judeans, are allowed to go back and do their stuff. Now, that was happening across the globe in Persia, the Persian Empire. Remember, they had 127 states around the time of Ahasuerus, right? He was a Persian empire, emperor. But the way that we look at it is not as if this was just a geopolitical decision. We look at this as this was a divinely inspired decision, important for the events of the time. You know, how would Tanakh view our times and comment on it? So here we have it. We have a person called by the name of Cyrus the Great. In history, I think the rules pretty much is that if you kill a lot of people, you get called the Great. Right, like Alexander the Great, Cyrus the Great. Right, so depending on if you get a certain notch, then you get called the Great. So Cyrus the Great was a very big conqueror, and he appears in many books of Tanakh, most primarily at the end, as in the book of Ezra. This is how the book of Ezra starts in source 7, page 3. Vishnas achas la Koresh merach pras. The first year of Koresh, the king of Persia, of Cyrus the Great. For the, as Hashem had explained to Jeremiah the prophet, and Hashem inspired Cyrus to send a letter saying the following. Okay, so that's a picture of Cyrus on the right there. By the way, that's not Arabic, that is Persian next to his name, with his name in it. So this is what his letter said. God gave me, vested in me, the power over all the dominions of the earth. Right? So, pretty much the whole known world was under the Persian Empire at this point. He's a very powerful fellow. And he decided that I should be the one to allow there to be a house in Yehuda, in Judea. And everybody who so wants can under my banner go back to the land of Judea and reestablish a house of worship for themselves. That's what he said. He essentially is giving them the warrant to go back to Jerusalem. There are lots of protests that weekend because people, the natural inhabitants of the Sumerians at the time were very upset about this and they staged global protests. But nonetheless, this is what he said, right? And he was the king of Persia, so he had the right to say where his embassy would be. So he made his decision. It's interesting to see, by the way, how Ezra describes this. Ezra, in the first pasuk, says, Ha'ir Hashem es Ruach Koresh. Hashem inspired Koresh. Meaning to say, he isn't commenting on Koresh's character. He's commenting on Koresh's actions. Right? And Koresh's actions were divinely inspired. And then he goes on in this edict to allow them to bring back all the priests and the vessels of the Beis HaMikdash, which had been confiscated by Babel, and they could bring them back. That's remarkable, right? This is the most powerful man of the time, allowing them to rebuild the temple in Jerusalem. And so it was. They went up, a whole posse of Jews and the scribes went up, or Israelites, Judeans at this point, went up to the land of Israel under the leadership of two people. These are the two people. We actually sang about one of them tonight. One's name was Yehoshua Kohen Gadol. He was a spiritual leader. He sometimes appears as Yeshua, right? Not to be confused with other people that some people might tell you he is. Yeshua Kohen Gadol. And his co-partner, his governor, was a person by the name of Zerubbabel. When I was a kid, I always used to get confused by who is Zerubbabel and what was Tzur. Zerubbabel was the scion of Yehuda. So he's from Davidic dynasty. He was sent as the Persian governor, Jewish Persian governor, to head the, be the political head of the first return to Zion under the Shivat Zion, under Koresh. That's who Zerubbabel was. Okay, so Yeshua Kohen Gadol and Zerubbabel are going up together. They take a whole bunch of Jews and they settle down. What ends up happening under this edict? Fascinatingly enough, it doesn't get so far. Take a look in source. We're gonna skip the top of page 4. That's where Yeshua and Zerubbabel go up. And then in source 9, we're told this is already in Perek Gimel. And however, and by the way, history never is linear. It's always cyclical. This is why it keeps repeating itself. So listen to what happens here. It's unbelievable. He says, Israel. So all the neighbors who had been here for a sum total of, you know, the amount of time that it took for God Babel to be exiled, so we're talking about a few decades, you know, are now here that the Jews have returned. So they appear, they approach the political leader and they say, haha, it's our place too, right? This is our temple also, right? So let's build with you. We'll do it together, right? One state solution, right? We will serve him as we have been serving him from the time Assyria put us here. So they're actually predating themselves. They're saying that we came from the times that Assyria messed around the Middle East, which was a couple hundred years before. Okay, fine. So they have more indigenous roots. That's as far as they go. They probably come from further east, because Assyria's policy was to mix the nationalities of nations. That's where they originally came from. Okay, good. Sorry, if you read the letter carefully from Koresh, there are no asterisks, no fine print that says anybody else is involved. It's just us, not you, right? It's our letter. We're going to bring build the bias, but thank you and good luck. So they started creating a pressure on them. They made it difficult for them to build. And then they started hiring PR specialists who would be involved in trying to make it difficult politically for them to continue. They invested in international policies, you know, social justice for Judea. They had all these organizations on university campuses that were now that were spewing forth all these this information, and it made it very difficult. And in fact, as we go on and later on in Ezra, they were successful. Koresh edict, an obstructive edict, which stopped the building of the Beis HaMikdash. Why? Because, or at least the walls of Yerushalayim, because of what they did. No, sorry, the Beis HaMikdash was built, but when they started to build the walls, then there was an obstructive edict that disallowed them to. And later on, we're going to see in the times of Nehemiah, what they ended up having to do was spending half their money on Shmira, on having guards, and half the money on building. Something which, unfortunately, we know today, Israel's GDP, you know, a huge percentage of that goes towards defense, because we're just trying to survive. Things don't change, right? So this is the original times. It was this moment of like, wow, we could have got there, we should have got there, we almost got there, but we didn't quite get there, right? We didn't really get to the same magnitude of a vision of what it could have been. So around this time, around the end of the reign of Yehoshua, Kohen Gadol, and Zerubbabel, they were in charge basically from the times of Koresh in his first year, and the way Rashi dates it is, 3 more years of Koresh under political pressure from the inhabitants of the area, and another 14 years under Ahasuerus, who came afterwards in this particular timeline of thought, and then another 2 years of Dariovish, or Darius II. And for that amount of time, basically things were grinding to a halt. People couldn't really do anything. And it was at this point in time, the second year of Darius, so we're talking now 3 plus 14, 17 plus 2 is 19 years later. At this point in time, arrived the last of the Nevi'im, the last people who had prophetic insight from God, and their names were Haggai, Zechariah, and Malachi. Some people say that Malachi was in fact Ezra, but we're talking about the last tier of people who ever spoke to God and spoke to us. And what was their main thrust? What was the thrust of Haggai's words? Haggai is a very short book. It's only 2 chapters long. Haggai is pretty clear about what he says. Let's take a look at this over here. In source 11. This is the words of Haggai. He says, Emor no el Zerubbabel, in source 11, Perek Beis. He says, Emor no el Zerubbabel ben Shaltiel Pachas Yura. Tell Zerubbabel, the governor of Judea, vel Yehoshua ben Yosadok HaKohen Gadol v'eshoi so'om le'mor. Tell them the following. Mi vochem anishar asher ro'e la'bais hazeh b'chvod ha'rishon. Amu atem ro'im osoi. Do you remember the first base of Migdash? What do you see now? Does it mean nothing to you? You saw it and you see what we're missing? Be strong, strengthen your people. I'm with you, says God. Make the house. Stop getting scared. Don't get scared. Don't fall under the political and the agitators' pressure. In a short while, says God, I'm going to bring this terrible storm which is going to shake everything. It's going to shake the dry land, it's going to shake the oceans. And the houses of God is going to be filled with my presence. So what he's saying is get up off your chairs. Don't worry. Don't submit to terrorism. I have the silver, I have the gold, I'm going to take you through this. This is what Haggai says. Similarly, his contemporary, who's prophesying on almost the same date, 1 month earlier, is Zechariah. Zechariah also himself says, if we just flip over, this is part of our Torah we're going to be reading this Shabbos on Hanukkah. Zechariah says to the same people, in source 14, Perek Beis, Ki kol marashim tzvakos achar kavod shlochani al goyim v'asholelim eschem ki anageh b'ochem anageh b'vavas enoy. Don't worry about those people who are hurting you, because anybody who touches you, it's like touching my eyes, says Hashem, almost. I mean, so that's how much it hurts me when people hurt you. Ki inani menifes yodi alehem v'yushalal abdehem. I'm going to destroy them, says God. V'yidatem ki Hashem tzvakos shlochani. And you'll know that Hashem sent me. And he goes on to say, get up, do, make, and change the world. Zechariah and Haggai were the last effort, ultimately, of God sending his message to build the Beis HaMikdash, to build Yerushalayim to what it should and could be. And the question really is did they succeed? Did Haggai and Zechariah really succeed in their vision of what Yerushalayim should have been? The answer is, what do you think? Did they succeed? Did they really succeed in transforming what the Beis HaMikdash could have been? The answer is, unfortunately no. Because we see later on, when Ezra and Nehemiah themselves come up, Ezra and Nehemiah are once again a pair of leaders. Nehemiah is the political leader, he's the Persian governor who's Jewish, and Ezra is the spiritual leader. They arrive a few years later. When they arrive in Yerushalayim, assimilation is rife, intermarriage is across the board. People haven't heard much about the Torah. The walls of Jerusalem are in disrepair. It doesn't seem to have had much of an effect, unfortunately. What all their fire and brimstone didn't seem to really get people into action. How could that be? Meaning, didn't God say he's going to do something? I'm going to be with you. I'm going to destroy those nations. So the Malbim says, the Malbim is a general principle, which one of my teachers, Rabbi Chaim Angel, calls the Malbim principle, which is that there is a possibility of Geula coming, and Hashem talks about it, but it doesn't mean it has to come. It means it could come. Meaning, when God says, I'm going to destroy these nations, it means if you decide to hold my hand and we do this together. But if you decide not to hold my hand and you decide to do your own thing, then it's going to be a lost aura. It's going to be a lost moment of potential. It's a window. An example the Malbim gives of this is like when you read all the prophecies of, let's say, Yeshayahu, the prophecies of Yechezkel, and it sounds like the second Beis HaMikdash is going to be this messianic age, and it wasn't. It just wasn't, as we see from around here. The Malbim says, yeah, it could have been. It should have been. It would have been, but it wasn't. Right? That's the Malbim principle is that a lot of these prophecies, they're stored for the future. But the point is they could have been at a very specific window in time, and it didn't happen. This is what we missed over here. The question really is were they fully void? Meaning to say, were the prophecies of Haggai and Zechariah fully void? Did they completely lose any traction altogether? And the answer to this is the fourth hidden Hanukkah of history. And that this is from the words of Menachem Liebtag, who has a very fascinating insight into this particular era in history. If you look at both the prophecies of Haggai and Zechariah, you'll notice something interesting. They both reference Hanukkah. They both reference Hanukkah very subtly. In the prophecy of Zechariah that we just read, a short two prakim later is the Haftorah read on Hanukkah, which is when he sees this golden menorah, right? Remember the vision of Zechariah, which we read this Shabbos as Haftarah, as he sees this golden menorah, and there's two olive trees, and the olive trees are filling into a bowl, and the bowl is lighting the menorah, and it's a lit, and he's talking to Yeshua, Kohen Gadol, and Zerubbabel, two olive trees I once heard personally from Rabbi, I'm trying to remember what... I'm losing the name for a second. Who was the first Mitnachel, the first of the Yeshuvim, was... I'm losing the name over here. He came to Karen Biavne, and he described that this is the two trees were the physical leader, the political leader, and the spiritual leader who came together to light the menorah, the new state of Israel that it should have been. This is the vision of what it was supposed to be. Even though Zechariah's vision of what could have been at the times of Yeshua and Zerubbabel never was, but the vision came in the form of a menorah. So when did it really happen? It happened 2 centuries later when the Hashmonaim finally took over. Isn't it interesting? Meaning what he wanted and wished to be wasn't, but it was later on. Because when the Hashmonaim took over and were able to push out the Greeks, that was the first time in the entire rule of the second Beis HaMikdash that there was Jewish sovereignty over the Beis HaMikdash. Remember, the Beis HaMikdash was built under Persian sovereignty. It was taken over by the Greeks, which means it was paying Greek taxes. It was only to the Hashmonaim that we ever pay Jewish taxes. Why? Because this is the moment that Zechariah was talking about, but it goes even further. If we look back at Haggai himself, remember that where he's admonishing Yehoshua, Kohen Gadol, and Zerubbabel? Listen to what he says at the end of this. Back in Source 11. Remember he says, in a little bit, I'm going to bring the storm which is going to shake up the earth and is going to shake up the sea. Take a look at the very, very end of that section in Source 11, the very last pasuk. Be'estrim va'arba'ola tishi, b'shnas shtam le'dorayove, shoyedvar Hashem al Chagai ha'novi le'mor. When was the next prophecy? On the 24th of the ninth month. Which month is that? Which month is the ninth month? Starting from Nisan, it goes 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7. 7 is Tishrei. 8th is Cheshvan, 9th is Kislev. When was this prophecy? The following prophecy of Haggai was on the 24th of Kislev, which is the day immediately preceding Chanukah. So his prophecy about all this grandiose and the potential which could have been was immediately preceding Chanukah. What does he mean when he says, I'm going to bring the storm? Says Rashi, the very last Rashi, the very last source that we actually have in this whole section. Source 19. Rashi says the following. In a very short while, Rashi says, Mishatichle Malchus Pras, at the very end of the Persian Empire, Hamosheles Aleichem, when that rule over you, Od Achas Takum Nimshol Aleichem, there's going to be another nation who rules over you, Lahatzer Lachem Min Malchus Yavonu Ma'at, Zman Memshalta. The Greeks are going to take over, and they're going to rule you for a short amount of time. But, Vani Marish, I'm going to cause to storm. Benisim hanasu leves v'nei chashmonai, through the miracles of the chashmonaim household, as a shemayim, the heavens. He says, v'yavino sheshchinasi shorei b'bayis hazeh. You'll know that really my shchina has returned to this house. V'yavio chashrois churois kesef zav v'kesef kasher kosev sefer Yosef ben Gurion, and they will bring back the gold and silver to this house, as is written in the book of Yosef ben Gurion. Who is Yosef ben Gurion that Rashi is referring to? Josephus. Rashi read Josephus. He says there's going to come a time where this bias, which you think is so lowly, is so backwards, is so small, is going to get its grandeur back. When is that? It could have been now, it isn't now. When will it be? It'll be in the times of the Hashmonaim. Isn't this fascinating? Even before the Hashmonaim dynasty was ever dreamed up of, already Haggai and Zechariah, the last prophets, are telling us, don't worry, it's coming. And you know that it may look, in fact, when they actually finally finish building this Beis HaMikdash in the book of Ezra, everybody, the elders, who remembered the first Beis HaMikdash, and they saw the second Beis HaMikdash, and they saw how small and humble and decrepit it looked compared to the first one, they all wept. All the newcomers were excited, they started laughing, and the pasuk says that you couldn't tell the difference between the laughs of joy and the cries of pain as they looked at this new house. And you can imagine the disappointment that people felt when they saw the second Beis HaMikdash. And Haggai and Zechariah, as the last prophet says, don't worry, there's going to come a time where I'm going to bring back the grandness to this house. And that is the fourth hidden Chanukah. So did Chanukah happen in Tanakh? The answer is no. But did Chanukah actually have its roots in Tanakh? Absolutely yes. And these are four examples of, in a certain sense, the seeds of what would ultimately turn into the prophetic state of Hanukkah. So that's our preparation for tonight. I hope it is meaningful, and thank you so much, ladies. Have a Hanukkah Sameach.